I came here to Washington in order to talk to administration officials and to people on the Hill on the major game in town today, the settlement freeze. Settlement freeze is introduced as a tool or a mechanism, a kind of a temporary cure, medicine, that will set out the ground for a resuming the peace talks. But in order to understand what settlement freeze means, one needs to understand what settlements are. And as one person I met today on the Hill called it, I already have a kind of academic degree in settlementology, which is the arts of settlements and settlers and settler community, and how that all fits into Israeli mentality and to the Israeli philosophy of life. And it does. It's a major issue. It's not just this proportion or that percentage of Israeli society that live in the settlement. It's much more than that. And the first time I heard the phrase settlement freeze, I was baffled. I was a bit embarrassed. Because settlement freeze is an oxymoron. Settlements are all about growth. They're all about enlarging the scope of domination, territorial domination. So settlement freeze is something like decaffeinated coffee. It's coffee without coffee. Settlement without growth, without a constant change in its territorial borders, is not a settlement. It's like modernism. Modernism is not about being modern. Modernism is about modernization, constant process of modernization. You don't get to a point where you say, okay, I'm modern enough. No, you keep on changing and you keep on with that process of becoming better and better. And that is exactly the same thing about settlements. And settlements are rooted deeply in Israeli psyche. And the idea that you can freeze settlement, not evacuate them, mm-hmm. but freeze them, is an idea that was created by people who do not understand what settlements are. And that's where lie the biggest threat to the idea of settlement freeze. Because it creates so much anticipation, it creates so many hopes. And those hopes, unless the issue of settlement freeze would be addressed in a much more profound and complex way than it is today, is bound to fail. Because settlements are not, and the settlement community is not a community that expands in one way by construction of new housing units or new neighborhoods. That's just one method. And to be honest, it's a primitive method. You need a lot of resources, you need people, and you need a lot of time. It takes time to plan new neighborhoods, it takes time to build them, it takes time and political effort to overcome political hurdles, foreign pressure, and so on. Settlers have much more complicated, much finer means of expanding their townships. And in order to understand that, one needs to understand the reality, the daily reality in the West Bank. The daily reality in the West Bank is such, and every Palestinian farmer knows about that much more than every Israeli politician. Every farmer knows that when he goes towards the close by settlement, his or her borderline is not where the build-up area of the settlement is. It's not even where the illegal fence that they built is located. Usually there is an unseen line, a line that only the people who live in the vicinity knows about. And when I go to visit my clients in this village or another, and I ask them, why don't you come with me and show me your plot of land or your olive grove? They look at each other and then they look at me and they say, well, if we cross that line, you see there is a tree, then we'll be attacked, or we'll be shot at, we'll be shushed away. And this, so eventually the settlement and the outpost and basically every structure in the West Bank that is an Israeli structure, military bases, settlements, outposts, a cellular antenna, grocery store, every structure is the epicenter of different lines of magnetic fields, if you wish, of domination. And these magnetic lines are in constant growth. So even if you don't add one housing unit to a specific outpost or settlement, the mere fact that the settlement exists creates by itself a process of enlargement. We've been trying in Yesh Din, it's an Israeli human rights organization that was formed some 4 years ago. It's quite a young organization, which focuses on law enforcement on Israeli civilians in the West Bank, meaning settlers. And we are in the midst of this project of trying to map the real lines, the real domination lines of the settlements, because all the maps that everybody knows about, the maps that show the build-up area, the maps that show the jurisdictional area, or the maps that show the ring road that usually there is around the settlement, all these do not tell the whole story. And the whole story is told by people on the ground, and this story changes constantly. Because this week, we know that we can't cross that tree. Next week, an incident will occur, and the Palestinian community will get the understanding that it cannot cross this rock. So it's a dynamic process. So using the word freeze, one needs to explain what one means. So when we are talking about the settlement freeze, unfortunately, I guess most people mean freeze of construction. We don't want a brick to be laid on another brick in the West Bank. That's it. And let's avoid all the discussion about natural growth or settlement blocks. Let's assume that this is somehow settled. Let's assume that tomorrow or the day after or in a week we will get an announcement, declaration that a freeze is introduced. The government of the State of Israel has accepted the demand of the American administration. A freeze, a total freeze, is imposed. Now, what will happen then? Well, assuming that the freeze is only on construction, we will have at least two processes that would undermine extremely the bona fide understanding of the settlement freeze as a tool to create trust among the parties to come back to the negotiation table. The first process, one that has already begun, is a process of rapid, enormous planning. And when I say planning, I mean a complete freedom for the settlers to plan on paper new neighborhoods. And I'm not just guessing. It's not something that I just invented. I'm involved in the litigation in the case of Migron. Migron is the biggest outpost, the flagship of all outposts, that is located east of Ramallah on a hill, on land that undisputedly belongs to Palestinians. It's a It's private registered land. 3 years ago, Peace Now has introduced a petition together with the landowners, and I was fortunate enough to represent the Peace Now and the landowners in the Israeli Supreme Court demanding to evacuate the settlement. Well, during that time, during the 3 years that passed, the Israeli Supreme Court allowed the government to have time to negotiate a consensual withdrawal from the site. Now, as long as there was not a change in the American policy towards settlements, the Israeli government was in no rush. Lately, and because of the change that is felt already, because don't forget, once we have one game, once we have one game in town, settlement freeze, even if it's not introduced yet, it's already a political fact. It's something that the actors on the ground already relate to. So, 2 weeks ago, or 10 days ago, I went to the last hearing on the Migron case, and one that after which we're expecting a ruling by the court. And the government came and said, well, we have a deal, we have a plan. And what the plan is? The plan is to relocate Migron to a different site, which is not on private Palestinian land. Where is that site? It's in a settlement called Adam. The settlement Adam is east of the separation barrier. It's not in the settlement block. And the new neighborhood is going to be located not inside the line of the build-up area of Adam, but east, meaning the Adam territory will expand. So even under the parameters of the alleged understanding with the Bush administration, this is a deal that contradicts at least three parameters. It's not in the settlement block, it's not in the build-up area, it's not west of the separation barrier. Now, the deal is, we will relocate you, meaning we will build 50 units so that the 50 families that live in Migron will move there. But that's not all. We will also plan a much larger neighborhood. These 50 units will be part of a 1,450-unit new neighborhood. It will double or triple the amount of people who live in Adam. Now, if settlement freeze is only about construction, putting aside the question of building those 50 units, this plan is not violating the settlement freeze, as long as it's on paper, as long as we're on the process of planning. And if the same thing will be done in other places, and the government did say in the hearing, this is our model of how we should deal with other outposts in the future. And of course, they don't have to say that. Once you do it in one place, you cannot do anything else in other places. So, what comes out of this is a barter deal between the government of Israel and the leadership of the settlement movement. And the barter is, tough times are coming. We will not be able to expand the build-up areas of settlements in the same pace we could before. But since our commitment to the international community is probably going to be only about construction, we will, in exchange, in return, allow you to plan neighborhoods in areas that were closed for you in recent 10 years. Now, you may ask, so, okay, but that's really, these are plans. It's on paper. It doesn't affect the ground. Well, whoever is an expert in settlementology, as I am, should know that this is anything but theory. These plans that are going to be issued and declared in next month will undermine the integrity of the settlement freeze policy. Because let's say that in a week or two, There will be this ceremonial declaration, and it will be a huge success for the American administration. For the first time, an Israeli government, a very right-wing government, accepts the idea of a settlement freeze. Now try to imagine that a week later, the headlines shout, the planning board of the West Bank has just approved a new neighborhood in Kiryat Arba for, 700 units. And the Americans will go berserk and they'll ask Ehud Barak, what are you doing? And he will say, nothing. This is on paper. No one said anything about planning. The Palestinians, who have even more experience than the Israeli activists in this issue, for them it will be a deal breaker. They will understand that it's nothing, it's not bona fide. Now that is not the only risk. The other risk is that the policy of settlement freeze, that is now, as I termed it, the only game in town, after declaration and after a few months pass, it will stop being the only game in town, and after all, the Obama administration has other things to do. And if time is ripe and priorities change, and if some things happen on the ground, let's assume one scenario, God forbid, that a terrorist attack hits the streets of Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, and the government is under extreme pressure to build more as a good Zionist reaction to the terror attack, and maybe the American administration would not be able in times of crisis like that to say, well, no, this is your commitment. Now, if we had a planning freeze, then the decision of the government to violate the understanding of settlement freeze would be in theory, because it takes 2 to 3 to 4 and sometimes 5 years to plan. The time of the era of settlement freeze would not be lost for the settlers. It would be exploited fully to prepare for the time of the great defrost. So that's one angle that you should think of when thinking of settlement freeze. What does it mean? Settlement freeze means only construction, only a brick on a brick, because every brick has a tail. The tail goes back 3-4 years of paperwork and planning boards and objections and legal actions and so on and so forth. So we're just dealing with what's on the surface. Second problem is, and I think I made a hint to that in the beginning of my presentation, that is the issue of settler violence. Now, I'm extremely emotional about this issue. As an Israeli, as a Jew, this is something that not only tears my heart, but makes me so angry and shameful of the things that are done on my name and on my behalf and by my brothers and sisters. But when we're doing a political analysis, and when we're not approaching the matter from a human rights point of view, which is basically the point of view that I'm taking, and we're thinking of the issue of settlement, of settlers' violence in a more relaxed way, we could think, well, okay, there are several extremists. Maybe they're not just several, maybe there are more, but basically these are hooligans, and they should be behind bars. But that's not an issue. That's not something that has to do with the political decisions that the state of Israel should take or the administration should lead to. And to be honest, I thought that is the case. These are a few hooligans. They should be locked. We should condemn their behavior, but that's about it. But that's not about it. In recent months, I would say in the last year, a big change, a transformation has occurred in the way settler violence is carried out. It's not a secret that there is a clear correlation between the number and the severity of attacks on Palestinians and in times when the political wind blows against them, or that's what they feel. But if once these attacks were carried out by hot-tempered people, racists, with as a local initiative, so to speak, well, no longer. Today, it's an organized, coordinated effort with a clear strategic goal. And again, this is not a guess and not a speculation. This is something that I am telling you about because I know, because I'm involved in the research on these issues. The Israeli Human Rights Organization has reached a very remarkable point in their evolution, and today we have research departments that follow right-wing media, right-wing websites. We are even members in their listings. We get their SMSs, we get their Twitters, we get their emails, and so on. And what we found out in the last year was that this energy, this almost Ku Klux Klan type of energy, was redirected by some kind of leadership into a coordinated effort to inflame the ground whenever there is a demolition of an illegal building or evacuation of an outpost. And if we put aside morality, the strategy here is extremely simple and quite smart. If a outpost is being dismantled in the north of the West Bank, flocks of young men from settlements and outposts in the south of the West Bank will set fire to crops and to houses and start beating Palestinians. And all the energy and all the manpower and all the resources must be redirected and diverted to deal with that. Because, as you know, in the Middle East, one wrong bullet, one wrong stone, one wrong matches, and the whole place is on fire. And we've seen that evolving into this coordinated issue. We can even give it a name. It's terrorism. That's what it is. It's spreading terror to gain political gains, results. And we've seen that not only being organized, but now we've seen that carried out in at least two or three different cases. Maybe you remember end of last year when disputed house in Hebron was evacuated. The settlers from Kiryat Arba and other places around came to Hebron and set fire to five houses, mm-hmm. and dozens of cars, shot two men, a father and a son. It was captured on B'Tselem's video, and it is absolutely clear that it was unprovoked. It was just a means to get a result, and the result is to attract the security forces to come and deal with that rather than with the disputed house. Now, the idea is not only to cause a failure in the mission of evacuating the house or destruction of an illegal outpost, but even if that happens, and that happened in Hebron. In Hebron, although all this happened, the soldiers have evacuated the house. They just didn't guard they didn't protect the Palestinians. But what happens is that it deters the government from doing the same acts in other places. So it became a strategic problem, settler violence. Of course, I must say, not all settlers, more extreme parts of them, but this is an issue. And if we're heading towards construction freeze and dismantling of outposts, this phenomena would grow, and it will jeopardize all the efforts done by the American administration, the European community, and by the government of the State of Israel, if it will be part of this. The last thing I want to mention is something that I just want to put straight, a common mistake that is, I guess, not a naive mistake, but something that it It is just disinformation that was disseminated by the Israeli government regarding settlement freeze. The Israeli Minister of Defense reportedly raised the argument that settlement freeze, complete settlement freeze, is legally impossible. Because construction reaches a certain stage where you cannot legally stop it. And judicial review will immediately dismiss the idea of settlement freeze. Well, I just want to make that clear to all people present. That is, how British say, rubbish.
We have more colorful words as well.
Bollocks.
That's one of them.
It's one of those things that is not really very complicated. It's not a very, you don't need a great legal mind to figure it out. There were precedences in the past. Settlement freeze is not, construction freeze is not the first time. The late Prime Minister Rabin has introduced a settlement freeze in 1993, and petitions were lodged with the Israeli Supreme Court, all dismissed because the clear legal doctrine, which gives a wide discretion to the government of Israel to stop construction that is in contradiction to its current policy, is a prevailing doctrine. And it also makes sense. If the government is empowered to withdraw from Gaza, if it is empowered to dismantle whole settlements, if it is empowered to pull out of the whole West Bank, it definitely is empowered to do much less than that. Of course, there is an issue of compensation which might arise, but that's a completely different matter. So to sum it all up, settlement freeze is an oxymoron. Settlement freeze, if one wants to deal with the idea of settlement freeze seriously, then one needs to address a multi-layer issue and not just the issue of construction. Otherwise, we will find ourselves once again, and I'm not sure how many times the two peoples will have, how many times they can rebuild their trust, rebuild their hopes, and then fail again. Thank you.
I want to ask Amjad to jump up here and make a few comments. And what I wanted to say to you by way of opening that, Amjad, is one thing that was missing in the original Oslo agreements was settlement freeze. Building, planning, the whole thing. Now, it's true that there was language there about not doing anything that would affect final status issues, and this is something that the Palestinian negotiators, and you've advised the Palestinian negotiating teams in the past and are probably much more familiar with it than me, but what has been the Palestinian strategy in addressing the situation? I don't want you to give us too much of a historical tour de force, but what we've heard from Michael is that this is anything but coincidental.
Right.
What goes on from the settler side and the state within a state, which is the supportive bureaucracy of the settlers. And I want you to see, to let us know to the extent to which it exists, and maybe it's a, we haven't got one, or perhaps what it should be in that context. I'd also like to push you on one thing, because it's current right now. The chair of the House Foreign Relations Committee, Howard Berman, yesterday put out a statement calling on the Palestinian leader to accept Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's offer to unconditionally return to negotiations and to not make a settlement freeze conditional. And I just wondered how you feel that plays out in terms of the Palestinian thinking and what's possible and not possible politically there now. And I should say that you came today from a presentation at USIP where you and others were discussing Hamas. So I won't ask you to go into that, but I just want to acknowledge that you were doing that earlier today.
Thank you. I'll actually keep it brief so that we can all have a conversation together. I think the way you've described settlements as a system of domination was not actually understood by the PLO leadership for a very long time. When the Palestinians who were originally negotiating in the Madrid talks, they were selected from inside the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. They understood. They had a much better idea of what this was about. But when the PLO was brought in to secret-track negotiations with the Israeli government, separate from the Palestinian negotiators that were negotiating with the official Israeli delegation, the issue of settlements was not understood by the Tunisian team at all. So the negotiations that they had with the Israelis, in fact, were often confused because the ideas of autonomy were confused with sovereignty, the ideas of interim were confused with permanent status. Many of the legal concepts that the Israelis employed simply were not understood by the Palestinians who were working on the actual Oslo agreement. Now, that situation continued, I mean, for a while, unfortunately. Yasser Arafat, when he was first taken from the Gaza Strip to the West Bank by car, told the driver at one point, according to somebody who was with him who told me this, said he was told him, tell me when we get into Palestine. And the driver said, well, we're already in Palestine. And he said, where are we? What town is this? He says, Ma'ale Adumim, the Israeli settlement. And it was the first time, and he became epileptic. He was just so furious. He didn't understand that a settlement was a city. He was thinking outposts. He's thinking the trailer parks on top of hills and a bunch of hippies that are just trying to hold on to the land. He had no concept that it was a fundamental and instrumental part of the Israeli colonization and integration of the West Bank into Israel. Despite that, one of the Palestinian officials in the cabinet for a very long time was a Palestinian who was running the construction companies that were building the settlements. So the Israelis could be forgiven for thinking that settlement construction wasn't a high PLO priority.
Or it was, but not necessarily.
Yeah. Or that stopping settlement activity wasn't a high PLO priority. Now, that's changed. That's no longer the case. Even for those Palestinians who may have thought that they could benefit from it or thought that this was a temporary activity, and ultimately, like George Bush said, these cities would eventually be turned over to the Palestinians to be used for Palestinian refugees. Even for those who had convinced themselves of this kind of logic, at the end of the day, there was a clear recognition that the settlement enterprise, in all of its manifestations, was in fact a knife directly at the heart of Palestinian self-determination. So the Palestinians became increasingly more adamant and more uncompromising on that issue, not because they were using it as a negotiating tactic, but because they viewed it much in the same way that Israelis viewed suicide bombings inside Tel Aviv. They were fundamentally aimed at undermining Israeli security, while settlements were fundamentally aimed at ensuring that there was no two-state solution. Now, the United States seems to have come around ultimately to that position as well. And it took the United States some time to understand exactly what was happening with the settlements. A number of people understood it individually, but the government as an institution seems to have only recently adopted in a robust fashion an understanding that this is in fact the opposite of a two-state solution. This is in fact the opposite of a comprehensive peace agreement. But that leads to the question of that if, as Michael says, this is a question of political will and nothing else, if this is a question of Israeli political will, American political will, then it means that what happens next will help determine whether the ultimate goal of a comprehensive peace agreement is easier to get to or harder to get to. If the United States is the one that blinks and sort of buys into the kind of mistakes that the PLO made, if the United States negotiates what kind of settlement activity can take place in the occupied territory, then it's going to strengthen the Israeli government with its right-wing constituency and weaken it with the constituency in Israel that wants a comprehensive peace agreement. If, on the other hand, it's the United States that stands firm to the principle, doesn't back down from the principle at all, maintains the principle that all settlement activity has to stop, and doesn't have to necessarily predicate that on anything else or on any next step, but it can predicate that on U.S. policy. U.S. policy says all settlement activity has to stop. They can even say it's illegal more forthrightly if they want to. Then that will strengthen the Israeli government with the constituency inside Israel that recognizes that a comprehensive peace agreement needs to be had. So when Berman, I'm sure well-meaning letter asking the Palestinians to enter into negotiations unconditionally, I actually don't have a position. I mean, if the PLO wants to engage in negotiations on permanent status, whether the settlements have stopped or not, it's an internal political question for the PLO whether it strengthens them or weakens them. But that's not what Netanyahu has offered, and that is not what Berman, unintendedly, I think, is asking the Palestinians to do. He's asking the Palestinians to enter into the negotiations that Netanyahu offered. Those negotiations are over the management of the occupation. They're not over a comprehensive peace agreement. They're not over a two-state agreement. Now, the PLO has already done this in the past, obviously, with Oslo and with other negotiations. And each time it's done it, the PLO leadership has emerged weaker. So if the PLO enters into those negotiations under these circumstances, in this way, they undercut the United States and they undercut the Palestinian leadership's ability to negotiate a comprehensive peace agreement. If anything, the management of the occupation should be left to technocrats, functionaries, people who are aware of where all the checkpoints are and which checkpoint might need to be removed, which one will help the flow of Palestinian business goods. They can have Palestinian businessmen involved in these negotiations, not the PLO, not the actual representatives of the Palestinian people. Those negotiations should be limited to only discussing achieving a comprehensive peace agreement based on a two-state solution. And I think that I'll leave it at that and see if we can have a broader conversation.
I think we'll probably stay here. Thank you, Amjad. I'm going to open it up. I want to abuse the privilege of being here and of your presence here, Mike, Michael, and maybe be a little bit mischievous. There's an advocacy group active here called the Israel Project. They have a set of talking points on settlements that have been made public very recently. The best settlement argument in this Israel Project material is that removing settlements would be ethnic cleansing. Now, one of the things they're perhaps inadvertently doing by saying that is calling Menachem Begin and Ariel Sharon war criminals, because ethnic cleansing was conducted in the Sinai and Gaza. Ariel Sharon is certainly no stranger to being called a war criminal, perhaps not by the same people who fund the Israel Project. The other argument that they've used is that the settlements are necessary for the security of Israel. And I just wondered if you could relate to both of those points, and especially how did the Supreme Court, with the Gaza evacuation, relate to these questions?
Well, I'll start with the second point, with the issue of security. Just like settlements, the security concept is also an evolving concept. And it changes in time, and it changes in its territorial definition. In the early 70s, the legal framework, the legal normative framework that the State of Israel has presented before the Israeli Supreme Court and before the world, that would enable legally to establish Israeli settlements in an occupied territory, was the need for these creatures, for these settlements, to help to secure the State of Israel. So, for example, Bet El, a very large settlement just next to Ramallah, was built on private Palestinian land that was seized for security purposes. And the IDF generals, the Israeli military generals, have signed affidavits explaining to the judges that the seizure of land is needed for security reasons. Why? There was this whole explanation that a sympathetic civilian community in the middle of a very hostile area is very important for the army. That's where they can be sure, they can go there, they can have their bases in the settlement, and the settlers themselves are the eyes of the army, and they generate security. It is essential for the security of the state of Israel. So that was the argument, and it was an argument that I was advised by people here before going to the Hill not to use the words international law. Does that apply to here?
we do sometimes.
Okay. So that was an argument presented according to international law. International law enables a violation of human rights in an occupied territory to a certain degree in order for security reasons. Now, let's see what happened since then. Since then, we have constructed the separation barrier. The separation fence was justified, again, seizure of private land for the security of the state of Israel, but not only for the security of the settlements that themselves were meant to secure the state of Israel. Now, there are no-go areas, closed military zone areas, that are seized by the army in order to protect the fence that protects the settlements that protects the state of Israel. And so it goes and goes and goes. There's a Jewish song in Pesach, Chad Gadia. That's it never ends. So I don't think that a serious general in the Israeli army today would agree to sign an affidavit which states that the establishment of a new settlement or the existence of a new settlement is needed for security reasons. To be honest, most generals would say, maybe ideologically we want greater Israel. That's not my role. I'm a military, I'm a soldier, I'm an officer. But security-wise, settlements are a big burden. So that talking point is weak. Regarding ethnic cleansing, well, this is something that is said by people who do not understand anything about international law and the status of the West Bank. The West Bank is an occupied territory. Israel is an occupying power. It's not bad, it's not good. It's reality, it's a legal status. And the legal status entails powers, but also duties and rights. And the Israeli army has the right and the duty to manage the occupied territory and to restore civil life and security and order to the region. It also has powers of all three branches of government. The military commander of the West Bank is basically the executive, the legislator, and the judge of the West Bank. One prohibition that is a customary prohibition that is accepted by all nations and recently by the International Court of Justice as a principle of international law is that an occupying power is not allowed to transfer its own population into the occupied territory. That is exactly what we have done. Now, Israel has a different talking point. The government of Israel has a different talking point trying to make a distinction between settlements and outposts. While outposts are illegal because they're not authorized by the government of Israel, and maybe the constructions there or the buildings there do not have a building permit, or they're in contradiction to the plan in force, settlements are legal. Well, that is also not true, and that is again not a very complicated legal question. Every student that studies international law would know that settlements are illegal. So pulling back settlers from the occupied territory is not considered a war crime. Actually, a war crime is to leave them there.
I'm going to open this up for a conversation, and if people can introduce themselves, I'll start with maybe we'll take two questions at a time. I'll start with Nadia.
Nadia Bilbisi with NBC Television. You talked about the outposts mainly, and there were noises made during the Bush administration. Now we hear, as the buzz phrase is, settlement freeze during this administration. Is it a kind of a foregone conclusion that the four major settlement blocks that you mentioned, Ariel, Gosh Etzion, Ma'ale Adumim, and the rest, Are they now a fact on the ground that they are going to be integral part of the state of Israel, no matter what, in any negotiation? And both the administration, the Israelis and the Palestinians, actually know that. So the negotiations also only will be entailing cutting part of maybe Areal more than anything else, and dismantling the outposts.
No, I'm going to leave the mic over there, and then we'll come down here to the front afterwards to.
Hi, Helena Cobden. Just a quick point to Amjad and then a question to Mikhail. Amjad, I mean, I think your critique of Arafat's negotiation was excellent. The other thing he didn't understand was that what he called bypass roads completely transformed the human geography of the whole West Bank. I mean, he was such an idiot. But anyway, there we go. Mikhail, there's Jeff Aronson and other people here are putting around the argument that getting a settlement freeze is so difficult that why spend political capital doing that? Why not just go for outright evacuation of the settlements without spending time on the settlement freeze? And although Obama has stayed quite firm in calling for a settlement freeze, he hasn't actually done anything to operationalize that call. So it's possible that he's, if you like, taking Jeff Aronson's advice. What is your view on the value of having a settlement, of getting, you know, actually expending political capital in this country to get a settlement freeze, as opposed to going straight to
evacuation,
the permanent status?
Right, so I'm going to ask Mikhail and Amjad to respond to that.
I'm not sure the question of fate of the settlement blocks, and by the way, I don't think that Ariel is part of the settlement block or the agreed concept of settlement block. Ariel is way inside the West Bank, 17 kilometers from the Green Line. I'm not sure that whether the question of the fate of these blocks is something that we can say that has indeed already decided. I think one thing is quite clear to everybody that is seriously dealing with potential solutions to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and that is that any kind of land of the West Bank that would be annexed to Israel would have to be swapped in a one-to-one ratio. Now, having, for example, Ariel in this land swap would create a huge problem for Israel to find vacant lands that it can swap for. I also want to make it very we have to be extremely cautious when we deal with the settlement blocks, because although if we look at the map, I think it would be reasonable to assume that these settlement blocks would be part of the state of Israel at the end. It's fairly reasonable to assume that. However, if we assume that without having a Palestinian negotiator in the room, that's again to repeat the same mistakes we have done time and again, and most dramatically in the disengagement, and that is to do peace agreements with ourselves. And that would never work. So this is something that has to be agreed. As for the settlement freeze vis-a-vis evacuation, of course, evacuation is a much better solution. And as I said in my presentation, I think settlement freeze as a concept is a very risky concept, because it gives the impression that something is advancing, while any type of freeze is at most, the best scenario, is just reducing the pace of deterioration of the situation on the ground. So settlement freeze can be used if it does not become a permanent thing, if it is really something that only ignites the peace process, the final solution discussions. And I have to say one more thing about the freeze. There is, however, a a positive potential that the freeze can generate in creating a some kind of a clash between the settlers and the Israeli army. And I'm not, and what I'm trying to say is not that a violent clash, but I'm trying to say that the freeze can create a clash of interests between the army and the settlers. And what fueled the settler movement more than anything else in the past four decades was the cooperation of the army with the settler movement. So that is another thing that is very important and might arise from settlement freeze.
I would just add, I mean, I agree with everything Mikhail said, but I would just add that I think it's important for the principle. The United States has chosen to make a point, and it chose settlement freeze where to make that point. And because it's connecting it to the system of domination, it's connecting it to the risk factors for a comprehensive peace agreement. I think the danger comes not in calling for and demanding that there be a settlement freeze or a halt to all settlement activity or whatever variation of that terminology that they use. I think the danger is in negotiating it. That's where the United States could easily fall into the same trap that the PLO fell into so many times in the past.
NATO.
This is a principle. It's not to be negotiated. I mean, it's the United States is also opposed to terrorism. We're not going to sit around and negotiate with Hamas what styles of attacks on civilians are permissible and what styles of attacks on civilians are not. So the United States has to maintain the principle without besmirching it in any way, because it's a question of international law. It's a matter of existential need to the creation of a comprehensive peace agreement. So stick with the principle and keep arguing and demanding the principle, but don't negotiate it. Because the only way to negotiate it is to compromise on something. And how do you compromise on the principal part of this?
I'm going to bring the mic down here and take these. We'll take clusters of you through.
Thanks. My name is Lee Diamond. I'm a Jewish peace activist. We've had universal view here in Washington that Obama is moving forward, is trying to do the right thing, and all that sort of thing from Palestinians and whoever, and some of the esteemed people are in the audience here today. And so I think that we should recognize that. I read the first chapter of Lords of the Land last night, and I was struck when you started your presentation by how much, how consistent that was. So if you wanted to throw any comments out about that book, I'd be interested, because some people think it's one-sided, but it seems to be pretty accurate. Now, I feel like, in terms of what I've been hearing the last few months, I want to ask the big question, which is, can we get on the road to peace? Because it seems like there's incredible resistance within Israeli society. And is the United States, for example, you know, wise to these tricks, or whatever you want to call them? And perhaps you could say something about your visits this week and so forth.
I can ask people to keep the question shorter.
Mikhail, you said something early on about the settlements are deeply rooted in the Israeli psyche, and I'd like you to speak to that, kind of the Zionist continuum from the 1880s, before 48, there were settlements, after 48, before 67, after 67, and whether it's been a Labor, Likud, or a Kadima government, at different paces and in different places, settlements have continued. So from a political perspective, is there agreement among the leadership of Israel that it should go forward, or have they been trying to stop it and been unable to, or is it really seen as a continuation of the Zionist movement?
I'm gonna, if you hand to your right, and then we'll take that last one and as quick as possible get through, and then we'll go.
Yeah, from this Jerusalem report, I have a question about the legal status. If I'm not mistaken, the Israeli government argues that it is not occupied territory but disputed territory. And they base that on the fact that under Jordanian rule, the Jordanians, in fact, that was an illegal rule, that was not, it was occupied by them. So it has to be determined who is the sovereign, and that's why it's not occupied, although they seem to, they concede that they comply with the Geneva Conventions, but that's not a must, but that's just their gesture. So can you address that question?
Yeah. You want to start? Well, I'd love to start with the third. Okay. The issue of the West Bank not being an occupied territory but a disputed territory. That is a legal argument created by one Yehuda Blum. He was a legal advisor to the Foreign Ministry of the State of Israel 30 years ago, I guess, even more. That is an argument that is not accepted by anyone except Yehuda Blum and some members of previous Israeli governments. It is raised in international forums. It's not raised in domestic forums. I have experience in dozens of cases relating to the West Bank. The Israeli Ministry of Justice is always conceding that this is a belligerent occupation and that it is governed by the Fourth Geneva Convention and the Fourth Hague regulations. There is an attempt or a double-faced approach here. In the UN, they would say it's disputed territory. In the Israeli Supreme Court, they would not. They would not dare to say that.
Why not?
Because it's not true. Because they do not want to get an Israeli High Court ruling which says that it's not true. So if they would bring it to court once and for all and say, we think it's a disputed territory, they will get a ruling which says it's not. It's an occupied territory. International law works on custom and consent. The whole international community agrees that it is an occupied territory. That's the status of the West Bank. Regarding the exact why, though the Jordanians were not an acknowledged sovereign, I can explain to you that later. But this is you must understand that humanitarian law and laws of occupation is part of the structure of human rights law, in essence. It's human rights. So the beneficiaries are human beings, unlike other parts of international law where the beneficiaries are states. So this is why international law would not agree to have a status where there's no law that applies and disputed land is nothing, there's no law. Regarding the Israeli psychic, which I referred to before, I'm not trying to say that there is some kind of a conspiracy here. What I'm trying to say is that Israel, for the last 40 years, but to be honest, 60 years, is this huge boat that sails in one direction. And it sails in one direction, and that's expansion. It's not for 6 years, it's more than that. Because this is the idea of the Zionist movement, and it's not a wrong idea, it's just an idea that should have stopped once we had a state. And this boat, when it sails for so long in one direction, every part in that road, in that boat already has ingrained in its DNA the direction. And in order to make a U-turn, it's not enough just to press a button. It's something that, you know, when I say parts of the boat, it's a ministry, a governmental arm here, and a ministerial office there, and an official in the civil administration, and a general here. They are all part of that system. They don't even understand that they are these messengers of expansion. They are doing what they are trained to do, and to change that, and I think Rabin wanted to change that in some way, and he was not aware that changing it is not enough to sign a paper. It's not enough to say, we're heading to a two-state solution. You have to reprogram the whole thing, and that's what I meant by the psychic. This is how. You know, sometimes I talk to Europeans or Americans, and they don't understand. What do you mean governmental ministries are giving money to an illegal project? What do you mean by that? How does it happen? I mean, probably you have forms, you have some kind of an auditor, something that can stop this. To understand that is to understand how it all works. It's all part of this idea. We're doing the right thing. This is what we are all doing. We are in the business of creating more Jewish settlements, not in the sense of settlement in the West Bank, but also in Israel per se. As for the question, can we really get peace? Well, I would say yes. I hope so. I think we are very close to the point of no return, where a two-state solution will be not feasible anymore. But we're not there yet. and we've made too many wrong turns on the way, and we lost a lot of time, and we shouldn't make any wrong turns anymore.
People are skeptical. That's why it's so important.
First of all, I'm going to give a plug for the book that you mentioned, Lords of the Land by Edith Zeltal and Akiva Eldar. It really is a very useful accompaniment to the health talk. We're going to take the last round of questions, and then Michael, if you don't get called on, Michael's going to stay with us. There's wine and bits at the back. So Tom, if you start right where you are there.
My name is Carol Coughlin. I'm a member of Peace Now. This isn't what I do for a living. This is for Michael. If you were to try to reverse this shift that you're talking about, how would you do it?
And I'm going to come.
Hi, Michael. We talked a lot about settlement. You touched briefly on the outpost. You touched briefly on the outpost. You talked about Migron. Migron's, as you know, it's not really an outpost. It's almost a full-blown settlement. It's not like Malon Farms or whatnot. Why is it that the Israelis continually promise the United States to dismantle these outposts, I think beginning in 2003, and they didn't do that, even during the tenure of Amir Peretz at Defense Ministry, who was sympathetic to these calls. And you briefly touched on the point that Migron is settled on Palestinian land. Why is it that it has a beautiful paved road and a cell com antenna out there if it's so illegal?
Could you identify yourself?
My name is Barak Barfi.
And we're gonna come down to one last.
Sorry, Franco. I have a question to you. First of all, I wanted to compliment you on the excellent presentation.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, it was totally unbalanced. You gave the impression that violence was only on one side, as if originally the settlements that were designed by Alon were not designed just for security purposes only. After Israel was invaded by five armies, and it was part of a plan. True, it has expanded over time, and it shouldn't. But first of all, let me just tell you that two.
I'm going to ask you to ask a question.
Okay, just one comment I think that you should be aware of. Salim Fayyad, 2 weeks ago, said that the settlement is not a problem and not an obstacle to peace. It's 3% of the territory. There are 1.3 million Palestinians living in Israel. There could be as many living in the other side as long as they live and integrate with the population and without hostility and without hate.
I need your question.
Well, my question is, why did you, what was your motivation to focus only on one side and give an unbalanced presentation?
Okay, thanks. Okay. I'm going to ask Michael and if Amjad has any comments.
Then I'll start with the last question. If someone would say that I was balanced, I would try to find the errors in my presentation. I'm an Israeli lawyer. I'm a citizen of the State of Israel, and I'm involved in trying to fix what is wrong about my country and my people and the wrong things that my people are doing. I'm not interested in my activity in the wrong things that other nations are doing, assuming that there were wrong things, and there were. Let them do their own study of how they should correct themselves. I'm not trying to arbitrate between Israelis and Palestinians to say who's right and who's wrong. I'm trying to see what kind of things are now a barrier to a peaceful life in the region where I live. And the biggest barrier are the settlements. And if Salim Fayyad said otherwise, then I think he's wrong. And if Salim Fayyad has said that settlers can stay and live in Palestine when it is established, then he doesn't know the settlers. Because I do believe that Israelis can live under Palestinian regime, but not these Israelis, or at least parts of them, not all of them. Some of them, maybe they can. So it's not a question of balance. It's a question of looking forward, not backwards. What can we do next? And when I talked about the settlements being created under the guise of security, I really meant it. And it doesn't matter why it was done. It was done wrongly, illegally, and now we have to live with the consequences of that act. And to the question of how to reverse the ship, that is exactly the, not $1 million, but several trillion dollars. This is exactly what we're all looking for. This is exactly, we're in the business of trying to find that that code, place where you plug in and the ship goes to the right direction. It's not easy. I have a guess that it's not just one button to press, but much more than that. It's about education. It's about legal campaigns. It's about what the international community can add to that. It's about many things. It's about Israelis realizing what is the price of not changing the course of this battle. I must say that Israelis do not understand what are the prices that will befall on us if we do not change the course of that ship. So if you have an idea, I'd love to hear that. This is exactly what all of us are trying to do.
Amjad.
Well, I'll just make, I think the comment from about Salam Fayyad, I think is a comment attributed to him at the Aspen Institute's meeting a few weeks ago, and I haven't actually seen, I've heard this from a couple of people, and I haven't spoken with Salam since then, but I know that there is a general attitude among the Palestinians who have been in the PLO, who've been negotiating with the Israelis, that they're not seeking an ethnically pure Arab state, that when they talk about Palestine and Israel as in a two-state solution, it never meant for any of the actual negotiators that Arab state would only have, certainly would not only have Muslims, but they always imagined that it would have, that the Christian population of Palestine would return and that it would also have Jews in it. And so to that extent, it's consistent, if Salam said that, it's consistent with the idea that that a Palestinian state with sovereign control over its territory would have people of all faiths, including Jews, living in it. The race consciousness that Avigdor Lieberman and other Israeli parties have is actually not matched on the PLO side or in any of the political parties that belong specifically to the PLO. If he meant by that, that therefore settlements aren't a problem, they can all just stay and they can continue building and that's fine, and you know, the most aggressive parts of Israeli society can be shipped in to live among Palestinians. I doubt that that's what he meant.
For us,
that's
it would what be he meant. Terrific. Yeah, you know, exactly. We would love that.
If that's what he meant, I think he was thinking about Mechel.
Yeah, that's right.
I am going to make.
Thank you.
I am going to make one comment on this. From my own background as being on Israeli negotiating teams for the government with the Palestinians. The position on settlement evacuation from any territory that would have become sovereign Palestinian state when we were having the territorial negotiations was always an Israeli position. It wasn't a Palestinian demand that wherever the area delineated for Palestinian territory would be, for Palestinian statehood would be, there would be no settlements. It's precisely because of what Mikhail said, that it was always an Israeli position, that it would actually be a potentially disastrous provocation for Israel's security forces to have settlements there. By the way, I can sympathize a bit here with Salam Fayyad's position. I actually think that the settlers are the least offensive part of the occupation. If you've got Palestinian sovereignty, if you've dismantled the infrastructure of occupation, and this is a Palestinian state, as Amjad says, but then you don't have the IDF, And whatever rubric would exist, which I imagine would be quite different to the situation here, for possessing a weapon in Palestine would also apply to the settlers. I'm not going to carry on. I really want to thank Michael Spard for joining us here and wish you well with the rest of your visit here. To thank...